Thank you, Emma. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Once, twice, three times greetings. That's a standard Māori greeting to many of us, and I will round it off at the end with the same, but with words that are more familiar, because by that stage you will be familiar with my voice, and hopefully we'll be getting familiar with one another a little bit too. Just to preface this by saying I'm talking about the New Zealand context. I'm talking about missions both in and beyond New Zealand as a physical entity. And I guess I'm assuming a lot of things in what I'm saying, and that might provide some grist for the mill later on as well in terms of maybe some gaps that need to be filled in. I'm primarily a historian of religion in the context of New Zealand, but amongst the many previous vocational incarnations that I've been through, I've been a high school teacher of geography, or secondary school teacher of geography in New Zealand. And currently I'm teaching in a pre-service secondary training program with prospective social studies and geography teachers in New Zealand. So I thought I'd begin the paper with three geographical perspectives that I thought kind of neatly frame the paper. Of course, the person who writes the paper always thinks these things fit better than the people who listen, so you can judge that. But the first was offered by a certain Northamptonshire Baptist minister by the name of William Carey in 1792 in his very well-known inquiry. New Zealand was an Asian landmass at the margins of the world, inhabited by just over 1 million people, pagan people, erroneously but understandably labelled New Zealanders, and it's just an etching from a late 19th century missionary magazine that sort of runs with some of those stereotypes. Relying on second-hand information from, particularly from Captain Cook, Carey posited that these people were likely to be eager and brutal cannibals, and furthermore, they were perceived to be poor, barbarous pagans, as destitute of civilization as they are of true religion. And he argued that their condition was one incentive for Christians to be enthusiastic in their effort for missions. The second perspective is depicted on a map produced by what was called the New Zealand Bible Training Institute in their magazine The Reaper, published in 1925. Now, as Geoffrey Cox recently noted for the British context, imperial and missionary expansion was accompanied by a considerable amount of staring at maps. And this was equally the case in the colonies. Maps were a great way of showing information and propaganda, I guess. In this instance, the Evangelical Bible Institute had only been recently established in 1922, was proudly advertising its early successes in placing its graduates both at home and abroad. New Zealand and Australia's cartographic centrality, very unusual for maps, was deployed as a visual metaphor. By the early 20th century, these Protestants, at least, at the geographical margins of the globe, apparently thought of themselves as being central to the task of ongoing world evangelisation. The third perspective brings the two concepts of centre and periphery together. In the recently published Atlas of Global Christianity, New Zealand is located on a scatter graph. It's a fairly technical sort of graph. It's number 15, if you can pick it out with the arrow, as being both a major supplier and recipient of Christian missions, Christian missionaries by 2010. New Zealand is ranked in these statistics as second highest in the Oceania region for the number of missionaries sent, and third highest for the numbers of missionaries received. The graph plus these two maps indicate that compared globally, New Zealand seems to rank per head of Christianity, per head of Christian population, quite highly as both a sending and a receiving nation.
Am I allowed to interrupt with a question? Are there white missionaries you're talking about?
Sorry?
Are there white missionaries you're talking about?
Let me continue,
okay,
and that would explain. But the information here epitomises perhaps what Andrew Walls has recently called mission from anywhere to anywhere, thus confounding these dualistic notions of them and us, or centre and periphery. New Zealand began the 19th century as the recipient of missionary attention, But by 1900, it was sending missionaries in significant numbers. Up to 1939, my calculations, around 1,000 Protestant New Zealanders had gone overseas as missionaries. The missionary movement that emanated from colonial New Zealand from the mid to late 19th century onwards was clearly an integral part of the wider Anglo-American missionary movements. At the same time, as I'm trying to sketch in this paper, British world colonies like New Zealand offered quite unique settings in which the distinction between centre and periphery were further blurred. These distinctions were rendered problematic by the emergence of parallel missionary and settler streams of Christianity within the colony and by simultaneous missionary ventures within and beyond its shores. And these ventures were also symptomatic of the growing emphasis, I think, on denominational Christianity from the mid-19th century onwards. There are also historiographical themes here. In our context, there's a lot of angsting about what it means to write New Zealand history, what it means to write Australian history, for example. And there is quite a reaction at the moment against the dominant sort of discourses in the last 10 or 20 years, which have emphasised politics, nation building and national identity. So religion is beginning to get some airplay again in the way that we think about our history and the ways that it hasn't before. So I'm going to try and weave my way around some of these themes. And all I'm doing is posing two questions. How do we think about origins, missionary origins, in the colonial context like New Zealand? And what sort of patterns were there? And then I'll conclude with some statements at the end. So firstly, I want to address the question of origins. That is, when did New Zealand become a so-called missionary-sending nation? Well, social historian Rollo Arnold, now deceased, talks about New Zealand as an alternative promised land in the virgin countryside beyond the seas. And he says this was the picture conjured up by British immigration agents, particularly in the 1870s and the 1880s. And it was in this period, the 1870s and 1880s, that New Zealanders begin to get interested in missions overseas, beyond their shores, and start sending their own people. And it's from this father's promised land that these people go. So one could conceivably argue that that should be the logical starting point for thinking about origins. And that's certainly that was one of the premises I worked on in my initial PhD work on this. But I now think that we need to go back several decades to the early to mid-19th century, where we better begin to understand that this is a very complex situation. In 2014, we are about to celebrate or commemorate, or however you want to say, 200 years of Christianity formally existing in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In December 1814, Samuel Marsden and a handful of Anglican artisan missionaries, completely dependent, it has to be said, on local Maori goodwill, established a church missionary society venture in northern New Zealand, some two or three decades after the first Europeans arrived, whalers, settlers, flax cutters and adventurers. These early Anglicans were followed by, Samuel Marsden, so I should have switched over at that point. They were followed firstly by Wesleyan Methodists in 1822 and by the French Roman Catholic Marist Mission under Bishop Pompalier in 1838. Now, to many of these new early arrivals, Maori were, to quote some Methodist observers of the time, a people of simple habits whose religion appeared to be a long round of absurdities. In actuality, the arrival of early British and French missionaries in the 1820s and 30s coincided with a period of significant change and upheaval within Maori society, marked especially by intertribal warfare exacerbated by the musket trade. So these missionaries encountered a sophisticated society and culture with a well-formed cosmology that was adept at co-opting Western society and culture for its own ends. Christianity, education, literacy, the Bible were all potent elements when introduced into this mix around the 1820s and 30s. Then in the decades surrounding and following the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840, that treaty that was between the Crown and the original inhabitants of the land. And prior to the wars of the 1860s and 70s, which turned race relations for us upside down, Christianity gradually spread amongst Maori in both main islands, as much by indigenous as by missionary agency. And in particular, many slaves released by the dominant northern tribe Ngāpuhi in the 1830s carried both the gospel message and literacy to their home tribes, thus setting off a chain reaction of religious transmission that often preceded or necessitated the presence of British missionaries in particular. As a result, missionary identity very quickly became ambiguous in this early period of colonisation. Rayburn Lang argues convincingly that the leadership of Māori evangelists and teachers was as critical as that of the missionaries with respect to the process of evangelising and Christianising other Māori, particularly in the CMS and the Wesleyan missions. A little less so for the Catholics, even though there were Māori catechists amongst the number. But at the same time, there's some evidence that Māori were also actively involved as missionaries elsewhere, albeit sometimes as a byproduct of other activities. Now, by the 1830s, they had proved themselves to be intrepid travellers in those very early years of European contact. They worked on whaling boats or in other parts of the Southwest Pacific. They travelled to Sydney, they travelled to Britain, they travelled to Europe. The northern chief, Ruatara, was one such traveller who became instrumental in Marsden's early CMS ventures in the Bay of Islands. So it's not surprising to find Māori also amongst those counted as missionaries, particularly in Polynesia and in Melanesia. Now, the details are patchy, but we know that the Methodist missionaries Reverend Nathaniel and Mrs. Turner took with them three or four young Māori to Tonga in 1827, and there were other individuals cropping up with Methodist work in Tonga, and also with the LMS missionary John Williams on Rota Mar. In the 1840s and 50s, a number of Māori accompanied the Melanesian mission Bishop Selwyn and Patterson on trips from New Zealand to the Solomon Islands. In 1852, this fellow, Henare Taratoa, worked with William Neal on the island of Murray in the Solomon Islands. And later in 1910, another Māori man by the name of Popoata, that's a surname and can't find a first name for him, accompanied the Reverend Gerard to Te Kopia. By the 1850s, some Anglican Māori were also financially supporting the Melanesian mission, and there's plenty of evidence that Māori churches, Anglican churches, were supporting missions later on in the 19th century and early 1900s. In 1908, Archdeacon Hector Hawkins and the Reverend Papahia scoped out the possibilities of future Māori evangelists working in the Polynesian-speaking islands of Melanesia. Now, their report back was positive. They said this is a plan that could work, but no further action occurred. And one source suggests that the potential cultural and geographic isolation of Māori missionaries from New Zealand to other parts of the world proved to be a very major stumbling block. Charles Fox, who worked as a missionary for many years with the Melanesian mission, comments in his history of the mission, somewhat pejoratively perhaps, that the Māori Anglican Church has never been missionary. How different, he says, might have been the history of the Polynesian-speaking islands if this recommendation had been acted on, and what fresh life had been infused into the Māori Church itself, for a church that is not missionary cannot be strong. Nevertheless, even though we have these modest numbers of early Māori missionaries going beyond New Zealand shores, the numbers weren't replicated in the later decades in any of the missions that I've looked at emanating from New Zealand, and that's an issue that needs further consideration. Between the 1840s and the 1850s, the early notion of New Zealand as a missionary-receiving land at the geographic and religious margins of the globe was further turned upside down by concerted European migration and settlement. And with settlement came a host of Christian denominations that developed their own priorities and their own agendas. This graph tries to represent the typical proportions of Protestant and Catholic groupings within the colony. We also have, by the end of the 19th century, Plymouth Brethren, or Open Brethren as they're known in the New Zealand context, the Salvation Army, Society of Friends, the Seventh-day Adventists, and also in the 1880s and 90s, Latter-day Saint missionaries to Māori. So there are quite a few groups, but that graph shows really the main groups. Now, while the colony eventually opted out of a formalised, established church arrangement, settler Christians proceeded to habitually form themselves along diocesan, parochial, congregational and assembly lines that replicated very familiar British patterns. They demanded clerical or lay leadership, and longer term, they demanded buildings and infrastructure. And so for much of the 19th century, it was inevitable that these churches, these groups, focused their energies on church building. Yet while this was the case, there is early evidence, I've put this in just as a represent-